So this is Good Charity, Bad Charity, the podcast that gives you the inside track on, well, what?
Well, I think we talk, we listen, we try to gain experience from people's work programs and how they interact with charities around, to try and learn and try and make the people that are listening to this podcast go, actually, that's really valuable.
And exciting, Keith. I think what we want to do is enthuse people who either think about charity, want to be involved with a charity, don't even realize that something like the Welsh National Opera is a charity and many arts are charities. Think about how many links they probably have to charity and come on board for the fun.
This is Good Charity, Bad Charity. I'm David Prest.
I'm Camilla McGibbon.
And I'm Keith Davis.
And we're on home territory, Keith.
Yeah, I'm really impressed. You know, I think it's about time we had someone from Wales come on here as well, you know.
We've tried very hard, but it is not Tom Jones.
Yeah, I know, but you never know, you know. Hey, he's just celebrated 80 years, isn't he? He ain't doing bad.
Can you say Good Charity, Bad Charity in Welsh, Keith?
Yeah, Good Charity, Bad Charity.
So we're delighted to have Aidan Lang with us. He's been the General Director of the Welsh National Opera since July 2019. Previously, he worked as a staff director there in the 80s and the 90s, and he also has worked at Glyndebourne and the New Zealand Opera, and immediately prior to a glorious return to the WNO, he was the General Director of the Seattle Opera, where he increased audiences for main stage performances, quadrupled what he calls millennial audiences through education and engagement programmes. He pioneered the use of opera to facilitate conversations about race, justice and representation. Now, the Welsh National Opera itself was established in 1943 by a group of people from across South Wales, including miners, teachers and doctors, and they wanted to forge an opera company that befitted somehow Wales's rich reputation as the land of song. So today the WNO has an annual turnover of £20 million, including a £10.6 million grant from the Arts Council. It's based at the Wales Millennium Centre in Cardiff, but tours regularly to Swansea, Llandudno, Bristol, Plymouth, Milton Keynes, Birmingham, Southampton, Oxford and Liverpool. So Aidan, thank you very much for joining us. It's great to see you and hopefully to hear your thoughts on where your organisation is at the moment. You know, you're a Welsh guest, but then you're not entirely a Welsh guest. You better fess up, first of all.
I guess I should, shouldn't I? Yes, I mean, I'm very English with a bit of Scottish and a bit of Irish as well. And I don't have any Welsh in me, as far as we can tell. But our new puppy who arrived just before the crisis, we named Dylan after Dylan Thomas. So there's our link, is my lawn-chomping puppy called Dylan.
Well, that's good. I mean, Keith is just over the border in Wales, so that's good. And Alex, who will be joining us very shortly, is in fact Welsh. So she's going to give us a big of a wave of the Red Dragon very shortly, I'm sure. So first of all, let's just get into the meat of things. And I know we're obviously going to talk a little bit about the impact of coronavirus, COVID-19, on the activities of Welsh National Opera, which is challenging to say the least. Let's just park that for the moment, though. Let's just talk just generally about how you've approached the Welsh National Opera, because you'd actually been involved in the company many years before, and you came back to take over control, as it were. How was that?
Well, on the one hand, things were roughly the same in that the format of touring a repertoire of three operas around multiple venues and then returning for a second tour hasn't changed. But what has changed is the world. I think the way people receive the arts, what they're looking for out of an artistic experience is very different from 30 years ago. And you mentioned I started as a director. My directing career carried on until I went to New Zealand to become the general director. But I think during that path, I gradually became more and more involved with the role of the audience in the overall equation. And therefore, when you start running a company, you ask yourself a question, actually, why do we do what we do? We know we do it well, but really, what is the core purpose? And having a clear definition of what your mission is, what your purpose is really the guiding star.
Camilla.
Let's talk a bit about the government structure and get that out of the way. So we've got digital, culture, media and sport, under which sits the arts. under which also sits charity. And yet you could claim that as a department, it sits way at the bottom of the totem pole. Do you feel, Aidan, that you're kind of always digging just to get to the top of the grass, as you used with your puppy? Or do you feel like there's some respect and you don't have to start from naught?
I feel there is respect. And if I know we're going to talk about the crisis later, but if there's one thing which has come across very clearly, it is that the importance of the whole creative sector and what our country will be like if it collapses has really come to the forefront of conversation. Creativity runs throughout all human activity. It may be more overt in some areas than others. And really what the arts do is give form to creativity, form and meaning to creativity, if you like. But I think, you know, in this country, the arts are not as well established in people's psyche as they are, say, in European countries. You know, you go to Germany, the Stadttheater is there normally in the center of town, or go to Italy or France, the opera house has prominence. So they have buildings which embody culture and have fixed ensembles who perform there. We don't have that. Our theatres in all our touring towns are receiving houses. They have musicals, they have plays coming in, they have cabaret, they have opera, ballet. And it's something we're never going to change. But I think that doesn't help that we haven't really ever cultivated that sense of the importance of the arts in people's lives.
When you're making a case to government or to the arts council or whoever you have to go to for funding, do you say, well, okay, what the arts contribute is that enrichment, that furthering of my horizons, that something that gives meaning to my life? Or do you say, all those people who come to the Opera House in Wales will spend money on a meal and they will stay overnight at a hotel? And that's one of the things I've always had a problem with, the economy case or the enrichment case, which seem to be butting against each other.
You've put it so well, because I think in the past, in a desperate bid to state the case, we've pushed too hard on the economic impact side. And I think we've forgotten that our USP, if you like, is the enrichment side. But I think people have very quickly come to understand the importance of the human connections which are made in a communal piece of art making. You know, the Greeks brought their entire cities into their theatres as a communal piece. It's why those theatres are so big. It was, you know, it was compulsory attendance. And maybe this period of isolation will actually give us a new life as people come to understand what they've been missing.
Can I just go back on that point, really? I think where the arts can maximise and demonstrate their benefit to the wider community is on this see it, do it, feel better because you're doing it. And if you take some of the work that's been done on singing, where they tested people when they started to sing and after, and their happiness levels through saliva testing or something clever, was phenomenal. And I think the arts have a great opportunity to push that side of it, and Camilla was saying, and not necessarily just always the economical bit.
First of all, I think it's very important to understand that an opera company is not just its big performances on the main stage. Actually, we have a huge investment in a series of programmes, community programmes, which don't reach the spotlight, but are equally important. Just to give a few examples, we work with a dementia choir, an ongoing programme, and we're very fortunate here at WNO. Before I arrived, a system of hubs was set up. We have a hub in Birmingham, a hub in North Wales, in Llandudno, and a new, fairly recently one set up in Plymouth and Southampton, where in time we will just be working with the local communities, really divorced from pretty well from the work in Cardiff, because we have our own work in South Wales as well. And you know, the work of each hub will be entirely dependent on the partnerships the leaders in the hubs make with the local community.
I have to declare an interest here, okay, so you're aware of where I'm coming from. I run a number of learning sets and coach and mentor a number of chief execs of charities in Wales. I know Andrea well from the Refugees Centre, okay?
Yes, right.
Who is very positive about the work that she's doing with you, you know. And having had a conversation with her since I knew you were coming on, okay, the things that she was saying that are going so well are things like hope has wings, beyond the rainbow, and beyond the rainbow about bringing in some refugees who are able to put their skills to use where they've come in as refugees and can't get a job, where they actually are now coming out of self-isolation and got a better mental health issue. It's a fundamentally fantastic way of going forward. So my question comes round to, how can you engage other charities in the same way, whether they're children, whether they're older people or whatever? Because if you're making that much success in that area, it may be better to do it, or sorry, it may be as beneficial to do it in other areas as well with the other charity sector. And then I'm not too sure whether both of you together could get money, as Camilla was saying, to put on smaller programmes.
I mean, at the end of the day, we are constrained by the resources we have. And, you know, we have to make choices. And one of the difficult things is to know how long to run the programme, because obviously the longer you go, the greater impact you make and the more meaningful it comes and the harder it is to sever it. And I think our approach, you know, has been to, this hub approach means that actually we're probably doing more than people in Cardiff are realising, because the same thing is happening in Birmingham, up in North Wales and the Southwest. Each city provides its own possibilities. But you're absolutely right. I mean, this can be applicable in the idea of using the act of singing and storytelling fundamentally is what we do as a release to all sorts of, you know, allowing people to express themselves and finding things within themselves they may have been suppressing is incredibly beneficial. If you reduce it to that, then this opera becomes an incredibly potent tool.
Powerful.
Yeah.
You've taken it that little bit further. You're actually using the stories and the messages within opera to almost sort of get to very deep social issues, political issues, whether it's about race or it's about the Me Too generation, as I know you did recently with a production of Rigoletto. How much do you really feel opera has the power to do that, that the straightforward classroom scenario can't, if you like?
The arts work on a fusion of emotion and thought. In other words, you are pushed into areas through the intensity of the experience, into areas you may not want to go, or simply listening to a lecture or a lesson will not take you there. And what our job really in whatever the program we're delivering is to find that sweet spot between the intensity, which opera provides in spades, heaven knows, it's, you know, it's highly charged, it's got music, it's got drama, but also to make sure that underpinning it are serious points and thought. So art is this balance of emotion and thought.
I mean, I suppose a few years ago there would be the old school perhaps would regard that education work as something which had to be done in order to keep the house open, as it were. My question to you, in a way, is how much do you compare the rave review about your latest production with the young man in the street who's come up to you and said, I went to one of your workshops, I was moved and I changed my mind about race?
I think it's really about not seeing them as two different strands. You know, you mentioned in Seattle, when we, for example, put on Madame Butterfly, there's a huge Japanese-American community in Seattle who, were telling us that they found Madame Butterfly offensive. So rather than hiding behind it, we then put on a couple of very public forums, giving a platform to that community, in no way moderating the talk at all. There was no one from Seattle Opera on the platforms. We just simply staged it. And that openness led to a real change within that community. So it's not just, you know, the old school was a little bit to, you know, to modulate the production to make a point. But I think we've moved on from that.
Camilla.
Will you have the resources going forward to commission new work that then may encompass some of the huge issues that are coming out at the moment without making it seem somehow as though that is what you are doing? You are trying to ride a wave, say.
Yeah. Well, you know, one of the great losses from the cancellation of our seasons was going to happen in this autumn was a big new work called Migrations, which we have deferred by a year because it is so important to us. A work which takes six different story strands from the Mayflower to a true story of an 18th century a slave who came back from the West Indies to work in a slave owner's house in Bristol, some Indian doctors coming over during the time of Enoch Powell. Now, that opera is a very, very ambitious work which involves a gospel choir, some Bollywood dancers. You know, it's going to be huge, but it's making a very, very profound point. Now, the loss of that opera in autumn season was a real blow for us. Coming to your point about commissioning, you're absolutely right. The best way is to write new pieces which can, in a more deft way, speak to the issue.
You've had huge geographical experience. You've been in Seattle, you've been in the States, you've been in New Zealand. What's the difference in their attitudes? Maybe there isn't one, but to raising money around this sort of thing?
America, of course, the government support comes via tax breaks. So the support is there, but it's not direct funding. What did surprise me, I think, is how ingrained this sense of philanthropy is in the American psyche. It was the day before I actually started, and I was having dinner with my predecessor, the great Spate Jenkins, who'd been at Seattle Opera for 30 years. And we were just in a quiet restaurant, and a young chap came over. He'd finished his meal and said, "Hello, you know, you're Spate Jenkins." And Spate introduced me as his successor. And the chap said, "You know, yeah, I'm a donor. I give $50 a year." He was a student. He was at the university opposite. And I realized that it's a little bit more than just it's a tax break. There is a sense that donors have great links to their cities. And there is a sense of citizenship, of duty as a citizen. Here, because we have a public-funded system, I think it's much harder to build that sense because there's an expectation that, on the whole, it's provided for by government.
It'd be really interesting to hear how you assess your impact as an organisation. And I know this comes to the heart of a lot of the difficulties with arts companies in how you do that. And Alex Scales is with us from Cass Business School's Centre for Charity Effectiveness. Alex, is this something that you've come across, this sort of dilemma as to how you measure impact?
Oh, very much so. And it's certainly that something that we cover on the master's programme in particular, looking at how you can best capture both through statistics and also through the stories that you can tell about what you're doing. So very much a stories and stats approach. And obviously there's been a lot written about impact reporting in recent years, and charities are increasingly being asked to focus on this. Still, we see many sort of counting what we would term outputs, you know, numbers of meals delivered, whatever it might be, without actually then going that extra step and sort of saying, well, how does that pass the so what test? What difference, what positive difference is that really creating? And I don't think it necessarily has to be a highly numerical, data-driven, complicated, albeit that if you know, more could get to that end of the spectrum, then I think it would be easier to communicate. But it's just really focusing on what that positive change is and how you are moving towards it.
Yes. I mean, the Arts Councils of both England and Wales fully, you know, understand what we're doing. And so in a sense, it's providing them with evidence to then assist them in pleading the case of the arts to their funders at central government or Welsh government.
The trouble with measuring impact, one of the problems I see, is that in a theatrical experience, the impact is often complete silence. I remember going to a production of War Horse at the National, and it was full of students. And the teacher looked down the line as the lights came down and said, "All crisps put away." And for the next hour, there was total silence. Those kids came out of that theatrical experience just in awe.
Yeah. And what's his over and over again?
You're listening to Good Charity, Bad Charity, and our guest is Aidan Lang, the General Director of the Welsh National Opera.
Taking you on a bit to looking then from the current situation to the future as you see it, you'd already mentioned that you've had to cancel a number of your productions. I'm also a trustee of a local theatre who are really struggling at the moment. Not necessarily, you know, we've got more money coming in support because people have said, we want to keep you going, but in reopening. And the fear that they have on reopening about distancing when we've got only two loos and two doors,
yep.
Only two doors coming in, we've got only one reception desk. And also, will the community still be as keen to come in over the next year?
Well, it's exactly the same. And if it's any consolation, it's the world over. Obviously, this is exercising us on an almost daily basis. We look at other countries to see how they are responding. You know, some went into lockdown earlier to see what their return rate is. The act of singing is a hot topic now. You know, what is the correct distance for someone who's singing? An orchestra is a little bit easier because it's a static body. But brass players, wooden players, are they projecting more? We play in a pit, not on stage, so that constrains it as well. Air flows, never particularly good in a pit at the best of times. You know, we're trying to plan with no sense of anything to latch on to, but we cannot put ourselves or our public or our performers in any danger. So as long as it's understood there's a risk, there's not a lot we can do in the conventional sense. So, you know, we're looking at some, you know, how we'd definitely put on an open-air performance, be it an opera, be it a small concert. There are ways we can connect with our audiences. But, you know, certainly for the rest of this calendar year, it's not going to be putting on main stage productions.
Keith was talking a bit about being on the board. What's your board like? Because some of them must have been thinking, I didn't sign up for this. I thought I was going to be on the board of a, you know, a wonderful artistic building and productions, and now there's nothing and we've got no money. And is anybody running scared, or are you getting a good amount of support?
We've obviously done Zoom board meetings, and actually they're a relatively new board. We had a lot of new board members come on just in November, and actually it's given us something to get our teeth into and to draw on the skills of those board members, which were very carefully selected, and so we have a wide range of skills. And, you know, boy, we're needing all those skills now. So some very informed and helpful discussions are taking place. We, you know, we upped the regularity of the board meetings because, A, to keep proper contact, and B, the situation is changing so swiftly that, you know, I write a board paper and honestly 2 days later it's out of date. You know, it's moving that fast. So therefore, you know, what we're doing behind the scenes is really coming up with some idea, a plethora of ideas which we could execute depending on which circumstance allows to do which one. You know, the great thing is everyone understands the situation we're in because all their colleagues as every other company is in exactly the same boat. So what I've seen, interestingly, is a communication within the sector, the likes of which I'd never seen before. We're really rallying and helping each other and any bright idea we share.
And what about the artists? Because you've got, presumably, a lot of freelance people, so there's an economic issue. And then you've got the people who are trying to keep at the peak of their performance level. They can't rehearse properly.
Yes, one of the players today in an email was just saying how, you know, he was aware that his playing standards, you know, this highest professional level may be slipping. you know, we're executing as part of our play opera series, which is aimed for 5 to 8 year olds. But we have players playing Ticerth, put the music together. We had quite a large orchestral piece, and the entire chorus all recorded a Welsh hymn, and that was pieced together. So we're trying to keep them active.
Yeah,
Keith.
Yeah, just building on that, because I think that's really interesting. I've just been watching the National Live, where I sit in a comfortable seat, I have a nice glass of wine, and I don't have to queue for the loo. So there's all those things that, in that experience now, I've got. I worry that I'm going to start to like that too much,
yeah,
and don't want to go out. How are you going to encourage me to come back to you now?
Yeah, I think it slightly varies from art form to art form, actually. I think the National Live, I also have been watching the National Live. And, but then again, you know, those are captured performances which have been edited like a film. So actually, yeah, the experience between, you know, watching One Man, Two Governors on, you know, beautifully put together thing designed for cinema and watching something on Netflix is not so dissimilar. Actually, this week I was on a conference run by an American arts agency, if you like. But they'd done a lot of research, and it was about the impact of digital work. Pre-COVID, the number one driver for arts attendance was experience of professional performance. It had shifted quite markedly to the desire for connection. Mm. So what people are... So, and actually, the liveness of which we provide is what is being missed. So as I said, in a weird sort of way, this crisis has helped us, I think, or helped our audiences to articulate or at least understand what it is that we provide.
Yeah.
So when I see photographs of you know, performances, a few which have taken place in distance theatres with two people there, one person there, all wearing masks, I think, well, what sort of experience is that going to be, really? Is it what we want to deliver? And the answer is no.
And maybe because we've been through such a shock that anything new that an organization such as yours, Aidan, would do is then not such a shock. It's just seen in the context of things are changing.
That's right. And I think our audiences, what we're hearing, are suddenly open for change because something is better than nothing.
Yeah.
When we emerge in this sort of fully functioning world outside of our lockdown situation, clearly, your first Carmen production is going to be throwing away a face mask in a very elaborate way as she sashays on stage, rubbing her hand with sanitizer and all that sort of stuff. But beyond that, what do you think opera's got to tell us almost about, maybe it's the brave new world we're emerging into or understanding of it?
I think the message will be, or the way we will be presenting it, is about this connectivity. And I think that will be the way we begin to tell the stories, not about the peripheral detail and not doing what we always tend to do is speak to the connoscenti, but actually really getting to the heart of what we do, what we deliver, what need we fulfill in people's lives, something we've never really looked at, but an understanding that we fill a hole in people's lives. And actually, as people come out, it's identifying what they've been missing and connecting with people that way is, I think, the way we'll be going forward.
I guess, Aidan, when you eventually come out of this horrific situation and things open up and people start to flock to see Welsh National Opera again, that's going to be a very emotional experience in itself and the beginning of a new era. It's been fantastic hearing your thoughts today. Thank you so much from all of us. It's been great to have you. Thanks a lot.
And thanks for having me. It's great to discuss. Thank you.
Keith.
I have to say I was very impressed with the conversation today. Yes, I knew one of the charities that they were working with, but to find out that they are up for working with charities and working with local people and schools and that to try and maximise the benefit, I think is a very big plus for them, for me.
Well, it's an amazing thing, isn't it? I mean, you know, he got the job in July 2019 and, you know, March the next year, everything, his entire world collapses, basically. All the plans that have been worked on so meticulously, of course, being opera, it has to be so far in advance. And the responsibility as well to all those performers, many of whom I'm sure are freelance and will be suffering throughout because of loss of work. Mm. And we've talked about this, haven't we, a lot, that, you know, people running organisations suddenly have to face an experience that they are not used to and not trained for.
So you have to think in a completely different way. Well, I think probably understanding your organisation from the inside out. Really interesting that he's got a board that sounds like he's got the right people at the right time who are enthused by having to make lots of decisions, because you could get the opposite.
But Camilla, this goes really back to where we started and where we came from with good charity, bad charity, which was you have to select the right people for your board that have got the right skills and the added value that will make your charity a success.
Alex?
I think it really underscores that clarity of purpose as well. And you know, that was a great move for the board and the team at Welsh National Opera to really take the time during this period. Perhaps they started it a little bit before COVID with the new board being formed, but really to address that mission and really fine tune what their actual purpose is, whilst at the same time making sure everything is relevant to the sort of 21st century, to today's world, as Aidan spoke about. And I'm sure having those really tightly defined parameters together with the ability to flex, as Aidan was talking about, it must make it a little bit easier to move forward in these incredibly difficult times.
He did say, didn't he, boy, is that board working hard for him now.
Well, that's the problem about choosing a board, as you say, because they're your mates, but it's also the problem about choosing a board because they can raise money. Because now you have to talk about what is the thing you're raising the money for.
Yeah, and, you know, I'm working with a number of charities here at the moment, and they're having to focus now on their exit strategy. What are they doing? They can't go back for the same old, same old. What do they stop doing? What do they continue doing? And what new do they have to do to continue as a successful charity?
And I think Aidan underscored that beautifully in terms of that balancing act that leaders have to play, particularly at times of crisis or huge opportunity equally, in terms of, between that financial emphasis and need and that social value creation that he articulated so well during the conversation around that sort of making a real difference to people's lives through the dementia choir, building the bridges between communities with the work that he does with the refugees. And the challenge for, like all organisations, is how do you add up all those small positive changes that you're making and then be able to demonstrate that to your complex stakeholders?
Yeah, and I think the difference for me was he was talking about it being meaningful. It wasn't just a, you know, an add-on just because it makes you look good if you're doing it. He was making it meaningful.
Yeah,
I think that's brilliant.
It was great the way he talked about using the community department, well, working with the community department for them both to work in tandem. So it wasn't just, as you say, a front for the work on stage, which was the mainstay, but it was both the community department and the live performance or the artistic performance working together to really create the change that they obviously really believed that music and opera can create.
And make a much more powerful piece of work too.
Well, that's it. You've been listening to Good Charity, Bad Charity. I'm David Prest.
I'm Camilla McGibbon.
I'm Keith Davis.
And I'm Alex Scales.
We'll be back with another episode very soon. Our producer is Dan Hardoon. You can rate and review this podcast. You can tell your friends. You can go visit the website, which is goodcharitybadcharity.com. You can become a friend and a supporter of our organisation, of our podcast. We are grateful, as ever, for the support of the Cass Business School Centre for Charity Effectiveness. To play us out, inspired by Aidan Lang of the Welsh National Opera, who's been our guest on today's episode, here's their special lockdown version of a Welsh hymn, Gwachodiad, I Hear a Tender Voice.